this week.
Engine ready, light on. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Engine sequence start. 1, 0. Launch commit. We have a liftoff.
I'm Gary Shepard, CBS News, reporting on the CBS radio network. The Soviet Soyuz was already in orbit for several hours when Apollo blasted off for a historic mission, the first joint Soviet-American space venture, a rendezvous and docking, and among other things, a handshake in space. Three Americans and two Russians in their own version of detente. Reed Collins has the story from CBS News Space Headquarters in New York.
On-time liftoffs from Baikonur and from Cape Canaveral led to a spot in space over Western Europe where Apollo joined Soyuz in the first international docking.
Docking completed.
Docking is completed, Houston.
Each side beamed to the other's native land best wishes and congratulations, and both Leonid Brezhnev and President Gerald Ford spoke to the five, Brezhnev through his spokesman, but Mr. Ford directly. After a full day of visiting each other's craft and sampling each other's space foods, it was time to close the hatches, and Apollo Commander Stafford wished Leonov and Kubasov a farewell.
We wish you the best of success. I'm sure that we've opened up a new era in history of man.
Saturday morning, the craft separated for a photographic experiment, then rejoined for 3 hours, and finally separated for the last time. Soyuz began preparations to return to a Central Asian landing on Monday. Apollo splashes down July 24th in mid-Pacific. The men plan to meet again in Moscow to celebrate that meeting this week at a far meridian in space. This is Reed Collins, CBS News Space Headquarters, New York.
It was announced officially this week that another Soviet-American grain deal has been negotiated. Some members of Congress said they intend to investigate because of the possible impact on American consumer prices. But Agriculture Secretary Butz argued the new deal for 3.2 million metric tons of wheat would only have a minimal effect. The 35-nation European Security Conference reached agreement this week on a new charter that calls for improved East-West relations. When it signed in Helsinki, Finland, at the end of the month, both President Ford and Soviet Communist Party leader Brezhnev will take part in the ceremony. The final document, which is not legally binding, sets guidelines for better political and economic relations and promotes the free movement of both people and information across political frontiers. Another complication in the quest for peace in the Middle East emerged this week when Egypt sent a letter to the United Nations. Secretary General Kurt Waldheim was told that Egypt will not agree to extend the life of the UN peacekeeping force in the Sinai Desert unless the Security Council takes action to bring about the speedy withdrawal of Israeli troops from occupied Arab territory. The mandate for the peacekeeping force expires next Thursday. Secretary General Waldheim, speaking at the UN, quoted an excerpt from the note explaining Egypt's position.
She is not against the proper use of the force. It is the opinion of the government of Egypt that the force should not, to use the words of the note, be used as a means of perpetuating the occupation of Egyptian territory.
Secretary General Waldheim says he expects the Security Council to take up the matter of the Middle East peacekeeping force shortly. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, speaking this week in Milwaukee, had sharp criticism for the Third World or non-aligned countries that now have the voting majority in the United Nations General Assembly. Although he didn't mention Israel by name, Kissinger's remarks were interpreted as a warning to third world countries that might be thinking about suspending Israel from UN membership.
The United States has been by far the largest financial supporter of the United Nations. But the support of the American people, which has been the lifeblood of the organization, will be profoundly alienated unless fair play predominates predominates, and the numerical majority respects the views of the minority.
In Portugal this week, there were surprising developments that left in doubt the country's future political direction. Bert Quint reports from Lisbon.
A week ago, it looked as though nothing could stop Portugal's march toward a one-party communist government. The moderate leftist socialist party, largest in the country, had quit the coalition. The middle-of-the-road Popular Democrat Party, the second largest, was to follow because there were no democratic guarantees. The Communist Party, the closest friends of the ruling military council, was remaining with its influence unchallenged and calling for dissolution of the National Constituent Assembly. The plan was to replace it with communist-organized labor and neighborhood committees working directly with the military. The series of demonstrations held by the socialists since then may have changed this. The turnouts have been impressive. Communist attempts to stop them have failed miserably. The socialists have demonstrated to the country, and more importantly to the military council, that they have great popular support and the communists have very little popular support. Socialist Party leader Mario Soares, who has been cautious in attacking the military, went so far last night as to demand the ouster of the key man in the council, General Vasco Gonçalves, the prime minister and a close friend of the communists. A few days ago, the ruling officers might have paid no attention to this demand. But the crowds the socialists have brought out recently are hard to ignore. Bert Quint, CBS News, Lisbon.
While the struggle for political domination went on in Portugal itself, it went on as well in the Portuguese colony of Angola, which is due to achieve full independence next November. New battles erupted this week between two of the black nationalist groups that are fighting for control there. By the end of the week, one of them had driven the other out of the capital city of Luanda. President Ford sent Congress this week a proposal to phase out remaining price controls on domestic oil production by 1978. When he explained his plan to reporters, Mr. Ford admitted it will mean higher prices for gasoline.
There is no cost-free way to reduce our dependence on increasingly expensive foreign oil. Gradual decontrol will result in a price increase on all petroleum products less than 1.5 cents per gallon by the end of this year and 7 cents by 1978. This is a small price to pay for our national independence from the costly whims of foreign suppliers.
The administration plan drew immediate criticism from the Democratic opposition. Senator Henry Jackson of Washington was one of the more vocal critics.
In the last 6 months, the Shah of Iran has not raised the price of oil. King Khalid of Saudi Arabia has not raised the price of oil, and the Sheikh of Kuwait has not raised the price of oil. The one man responsible for America's increase in oil prices in the last 6 months is Gerald Ford. Today, President Ford wants to raise the price of oil still more.
As the week ended, the president's plan to decontrol oil prices appeared headed for stiff opposition in Congress. At the same time, Mr. Ford announced his intention to veto Democratic-sponsored legislation that would extend price controls on domestic oil and roll back current oil prices. Détente in space, but antagonism over energy policy on Capitol Hill. Two elements of The World This Week, which is produced by Harry Poloshin. I'm Gary Shepard, CBS News.